From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I'm a sepophiliac, a lover of the onion, to use a phrase coined by writer Mark Kurlansky. My father was a baker in the Navy on a destroyer escort during World War I, and he told me that to prepare for serving each meal, the cooks on the griddle would chop and saute onions so that the aroma would pervade the ship and open the sailors' appetites. My appetite was extremely opened by Mark Kurlansky's latest deep dive, this time into the core of an onion. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
I love onions so much. When I saw that that was your latest subject to delve into, I was just so delighted.
Yeah, I like your story about, was it your father?
My father.
Yeah, I mean, I always notice when you have people over for dinner, if you just saute some onions before they come over and they say, ooh, something smells good.
Always. So let's start with the onion itself. What is it? And explain the layers to us.
Well, an onion is actually similar to a tulip. It's a bulb that produces a flower. All of the layers, each layer is the food for a different shoot. And onions are flowering plants. They have kind of pretty little pink or white, sometimes purple flowers and clusters. The deal is that once it's flowered, the bulb isn't good to eat anymore because it's given its all to the flower. And that's why we don't realize often that onions are flowering plants, because we harvest them before they get their flowers. But actually, some people do plant onions in their gardens as ornamental flowers.
They're really exquisite, some of them.
And an onion field is gorgeous.
You say that onions were one of the first foods of human design. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, we don't actually know what the first wild onion was that was cultivated. I mean, there are many wild onions around still, but we don't know what wild onion cultivated onions come from, which is sort of a disadvantage. You know, it's like, you know, wolves give you an insight into dogs. We don't know what the onion wolf is.
And they're very regional. I mean, there are different types of wild onions all over the world.
Yes, that's right. And they grow in almost any kind of soil in any kind of climate. They grow in the desert, and they grow in tropics, and they grow in the Arctic. They're very tough. And of course, the thing that's really special about onions is that it's the rare plant that has its own defense mechanism. You know, you mess with it, and it fights back, spits in your eye.
Yes, it does. So let's get into that. Why do onions make us cry?
Onions have a mechanism which was probably designed to protect them from mammals. You know, if you have a garden and rabbits go in, they'll eat all your vegetables, but they won't eat the onions because you get hurt. We're the only mammal that think it's worth the pain. When you cut into an onion or bite into an onion, it releases a gas, and this gas heads for moisture, and so it goes right to your eyes, and it's a sulfur compound that really it kind of hurts, and it makes you cry.
There are hundreds of folk suggestions for dealing with the pain of cutting onions, from putting a wooden spoon in your mouth to wearing a gas mask. Is there anything that actually works?
Well, one thing that kind of works that for some reason is rarely mentioned is to just wear glasses. Yeah, that won't fully protect you, but it helps a lot. But there is a thing called onion goggles. And, you know, we live in an age when chefs like to be cool, and you don't look cool when you're chopping onions with your goggles on. So most people don't do it, but there are onion goggles if you want them. You can chop onions by running water, and that helps somewhat because, as I said, this gas is attracted to moisture, so some of it will go off towards the water rather than your eyes. But it'll still get you a little.
I understand that there's a scalding technique, though, that a woman named Florence Irwin came up with.
Well, yeah, if you put them just for a second in hot water, that weakens them. And the other thing that weakens them is if you refrigerate them. onions get sluggish when they're feeling cold.
So are they good for us? My mother lived to be 95, and she ate probably the equivalent of an entire raw onion every single day of her life. And I've always attributed some of her good health and vigor.
She ate it raw?
Yeah.
Like an apple? She'd just bite on it like an apple?
No, I would say throughout the day, raw onion was sprinkled in every dish. Like if there was a salad, there was raw onion. If there was egg salad, there was raw onion. Tuna salad, raw onion. A sandwich, there was raw onion on the side to munch on.
Yeah, well, there's lots of belief in the health properties of onions. And they go back to ancient times and in a lot of cultures and ancient Indian and Greek and Egyptian and Chinese. And, some of them have some science to them. A lot of them don't. There's some good vitamins and vitamin C and things in onions.
Onions were used to prevent scurvy back in the day.
Yes, and that works. That actually works. But onions are also credited with a lot of things that seem kind of dubious, like curing baldness. And of course, there's all kinds of beliefs in onions as an aphrodisiac.
Is that one reason why there are still so many crazy ordinances that are still on the books in the U.S. dealing with onions? The ordinance in Ridgeland, South Carolina says that a woman weighing more than 200 pounds cannot be seen eating onions in a restaurant or at a public picnic if she is wearing shorts.
Yeah, that's a little disturbing. And actually, a lot of these onion ordinances have a kind of a sexist undertone to them. There seems to be more concern about women eating raw onions than men. I don't know
100%,
why.
100%. So let's start talking about recipes by beginning with onion soup because, you know, we have to go there. There's a chef who's autobiography I really love. It's one of my favorite chef autobiographies, and that is Henri Charpentier. And I guess I particularly love him because he had this restaurant in Los Angeles. Could you talk a little bit about him and about his recipe, if you remember it?
Yeah. He made onion soup for Teddy Roosevelt. You know, the question is this going to be as good as the onion soup in Paris? And Roosevelt thought it was better. You know, the interesting thing is that, as a French chef staking his reputation on onion soup. Alain Sandrin, who's now gone, who's a great Paris chef, told me that if you wanted to sober up, that you shouldn't put the cheese in the soup.
Well, that's so interesting. Most people think the more greasy fat you have in there, the better it is.
I don't know. I have never had the experience of getting drunk and then having onion soup.
Nor I have to say. You cover so many different kinds of recipes in the book, you know. Could you pick a category and maybe share one of your favorite recipes from the book, or just pick a favorite recipe that has a great story that you like to make as well?
Well, there's a few that come to mind. I love vichyssoise, which for some reason I had a lot when I was a kid. People think of vichyssoise as a French dish, but it's not. It's American. It's New York, invented by a Frenchman, Diat, in New York City. I don't think anybody makes it anymore. It's just a wonderful thing. It's with a lot of different things, you know, onions and leeks and cream and chives, and it's cold.
And potatoes, remember, which carry the whole thing.
And potatoes, yes, yeah. Another recipe that's kind of vanished that I like a lot is creamed onions. You ever have creamed onions?
Maybe when I was a child at Thanksgiving.
Yes, it used to be a Thanksgiving dish, but hardly anybody does it. Although recently a friend of mine told me that his family still does it for Thanksgiving.
I think people don't make it anymore because the idea of peeling those little onions is just overwhelming.
Yeah. There again, you can toss them in the boiling water for 2 seconds and take them out and they'll peel a lot more easily. Do you know the movie They Died With Their Boots On?
No, remind me.
This is a very strange thing. It's a movie starring Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland. And it's the story of George Armstrong Custer as a heroic figure, which right there is kind of a stretch. But apparently historically true, this movie points out that he was a fanatic for onions. And so there's Errol Flynn eating onions at West Point and eating onions in the Civil War and eating onions out west. And there's this scene in Washington during the Civil War with Winfred Scott, general. And they're sharing a bowl of creamed onions. It's the last creamed onions in the restaurant. And there's like a 15-minute scene where they're discussing creamed onions.
Pardon me, sir. Mr. Custer, sir. I couldn't help overhearing what you said, General. These onions have just been served me. I deem it a pleasure, sir, if you'd accept them.
That's very generous, sir. But I couldn't deprive you of them.
Oh, please. That is of all of them.
Will you lunch with me, Mr. Custer?
Thank you, sir.
And they're walking out of the restaurant, and Winfred Scott is giving Custer all sorts of tips on the proper way to cook onions. And probably nobody ever notices this, but it's a very odd thing, the courts of Olivia de Havilland eating onions.
I'm amazed that Flynn agreed to do it.
Yeah, well, it's, you know... It should have been they died with their onions. You
know? What is like the weirdest either use of an onion or onion dish that you found in your research?
Oh, the weirdest. I'll tell you what the weirdest is. Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway likes sandwiches of raw onions and peanut butter.
Oh my gosh. That is odd.
Yeah, I pack a bunch to go fishing. I always thought fishing with him would be a weird experience anyway, but the peanut butter onion sandwiches really does it.
I love talking to you. Thank you so much, Mark.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That was author, journalist, and illustrator Mark Kurlansky. His latest book is The Core of an Onion, Peeling the Rarest Common Food, featuring more than 100 historical recipes. If you want to try your hand at making Henri Charpentier's French onion soup, we've got an excerpt from the book that tells you how on our website. Just head to kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, the dark side of the onion, when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. In the early 1930s, a farmer in Georgia discovered Vidalia onions. The state's farming landscape has never been the same. Sweeter and milder than most onion varieties, they became Georgia's official state vegetable in 1990. The big thing about Vidalia onions is that they aren't supposed to make you cry, but learning about the working and living conditions endured by the people who harvest, bag, and load them might make you want to. Journalist Shane Mitchell, who has won multiple James Beard Awards for her work, unpeeled the problems of the Vidalia onion harvest for The Bitter Southerner. Hi, Shane.
Hi, Evan.
Your essay for The Bitter Southerner was just, you know, chef's kiss. What a piece of writing. Tell us a little bit about Vidalia onions. What makes them so special in terms of their flavor?
Well, the thing about Vidalia onions themselves is they're a type of sweet onion. It's a cross between two different types of onions. And what you get is one that has a very low sulfur content. The Vidalia is a yellow granix, which is a hybridized cross between a round Texas early grano 951C and another parent, which is derived from a flat white Bermuda onion. And in Southeast Georgia, what happens is it's on the leading edge of the Atlantic coastal plain. And the region's soil is uniquely low in sulfur content, and that's what influences onion flavor and odor. And so the sweeter the onion, the fewer the tears. And that's why Vidalias became such a special crop.
They also have a really fantastic crunch.
Yes, they do. A lot of people like to eat them raw.
Yeah, they make a great onion sandwich. Yeah.
Yes, yes, that's true.
So what is involved in the actual growing and harvesting of Vidalias? Who does the work?
Okay, so by and large, what happens is most of these farmers employ contractors to sign up workers who will work a crop or a seasonal harvest. Most of them are H-2A visa workers. They're recruited generally through various channels, and the contractors are the ones responsible for getting these workers to every farm who is contracted for this kind of work. And it has to be done through a very complicated system, which involves federal oversight. So essentially, what you're seeing are large groups of mostly men arriving for a season to harvest onions. But it's not just onions. They also harvest a wide variety of crops, in the same region.
Are we mostly talking about workers from Mexico and Central America?
Yes. Although there are workers also from parts of the Caribbean.
For the people who work the onion fields, what are the conditions like? Can you kind of describe an average day for us?
Sure. For instance, it starts before dawn. Workers are usually brought to the field on school buses, converted school buses. They're dropped off. They work through the day. Ideally, they're supposed to be able to break for lunch, break for water drinks, break for shade. It can be incredibly grueling because Georgia, even in April when the harvest tends to take place for onions, we're talking like 90 degrees plus in very hot sandy fields. And you want to be able to wear long-sleeved shirts and long-sleeved pants and heavy boots because you need protection from the sun. So you're risking things like heat stroke and other sort of heat-related illnesses. And then, you work through the day, and usually by the end of the day, when the sun goes down, then you're brought back to your living quarters and start all over again the next day.
And what do people usually get paid for doing this work?
It varies, and there's an established rate. The current hourly pay when I reported the story was $11.99 for an onion worker. But the piece rate is variable, which means the type of crop you're harvesting, and it's based on units harvested. So you can, like, $12 can really be like $9. And it just depends on how honest your contractor is that you're contracted to. He might be skimming some money. He might be charging you for transportation or housing or food. So it's not necessarily all that great a pay rate.
You write in your story, quote, "At least 7 years ago and possibly earlier, unscrupulous contractors began cutting corners, falsifying applications, downright cheating workers out of their wages and worse." Was there some particular impetus for this to start happening then? Haven't there kind of always been plenty of labor violations and unscrupulous business practices happening in fields long before then?
There have. And, this is historic. It's cyclical and historic. What's happening is the contractors have gotten more and more squeezed and more squeezed financially. What used to be a pretty good deal has gotten worse. and they're cutting corners, especially with regard to things like housing. And so essentially what was taking place is contractors were looking for ways to make more money because they weren't making enough to really make a go of it. So what they were doing was putting these workers in worse and worse conditions. And it became incredibly corrupt in that, you know, some of these contractors were incredibly unscrupulous about how they treated the workers. It's pretty egregious if you read the Operation Blooming Onion indictment.
Tell us about Operation Blooming Onion.
Okay, Operation Blooming Onion is ongoing, but it was essentially the Department of Justice indicted a number of individuals for their practices. It involved human trafficking, it involved theft of wages, it involved people being sold, people being treated poorly, people being threatened at gunpoint, people being raped, people being physically abused, and imprisoned. So, as I said, it's ongoing. There was about two dozen original individuals who were cited in the indictment, but I've been told by the Department of Justice that they're expanding their investigation now.
Could you tell us a little more deeply about the trafficking element? Are they taken to other states without their consent? What goes on there?
Yes. Essentially, it starts in their home country. They decide that they want to go on the journey. It starts legitimately, so they have to apply for a visa, and they are supposed to receive the visa, get travel plans ready, and they cross the border. They are documented workers, and they're generally taken to the place where they're supposed to work and where they're supposed to be housed. Then they do their job, they send money home, and technically as their contract expires, they're expected to go home. But what sometimes happens is they either want to stay or they want to sign up for another season. And if you wind up signing up with the wrong contractor, things change fast. You might wind up suddenly not having control of your own life. Some contractors have told workers, you now are not picking onions, you're now going to go pick blueberries, and we're going to take you to this other farm, and that's where you're going to work. And most of these people really have very little choice in this, and so they generally tend to go along with it because, quite frankly, it's still a better deal to work here in the U.S. than it is to work at home.
To what extent are transnational criminal organizations involved in Vidalia Onions and this kind of exploitation of the people who work the fields?
I think the point, Evan, is that it's not just onions. This is every crop in America. And transnational criminal organizations are very deeply embedded in this. But it's, as I heard from a United Farm Worker agent that I talked to, she said, these crops are small change compared to, say, chicken processing, which is a much more massive operation. So unfortunately, sometimes crops like an onion crop are so tiny compared to like soybeans or corn, which are billion-dollar industries, that it just escapes notice. That's what's been going on.
When do you think the case will finally resolve, or do you think it ever will?
According to the documents that I've seen, the court proceedings have just slowed down to a snail's crawl. that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it definitely means that they have to take their time to really look at how widespread this practice is at this point. There's a particular legal term for slowing down a case when they discover that they really require more time to really investigate this properly rather than just indict one or two individuals.
Yeah, we should say that the Southern District of Georgia unsealed a 54-count indictment detailing felony charges for 24 conspirators on mail fraud, international forced labor trafficking, money laundering, and witness tampering.
That's
right. It's like a RICO situation.
Yeah, it is. It very much is. And unfortunately, this is only one incident of it. That's the really tragic aspect. It's a broken system. These are workers who are supposed to be guest workers. They should be treated humanely. Without these workers, you don't get anything in the produce aisle of your supermarket.
Well, Shane, thank you so much. Thank you for doing the work that you do.
Evan, thank you very much. It's really, I appreciate you saying that.
That was journalist Shane Mitchell talking about Vidalia Onions. You'll find a link to her James Beard award-winning story, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, which she wrote for The Bitter Southerner, on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Hand pies. Are they really pies? Well, the crust lover in me says, who cares? They're delicious. And so this year, we've added a hand pie category to our pie contest. Here to talk about them is Sherry Yard, famed pastry chef and cookbook author who also makes craveable hand pies. Hi, Sherry.
Hey, Evan. Thanks for having me.
You know, I have to tell you that last year, you schlepped all of these hand pies to the contest so that we could eat them, and somehow they completely got forgotten. And then at the very end, as we were leaving, I grabbed a couple, and I wish I had grabbed all of them. I thought about them for days afterwards because they were so good.
Oh, thank you.
So tell me what, in your mind, is the definition of a hand pie?
I think it's just a mini pie that's been turned over. And then it has pie dough, of course. It has a filling. It should have all the trappings of a pie, the crust that goes around the outside, the beautiful decadent filling on the inside, a golden crispy crust, nice and dark golden brown. And you can just hold it in your hand and have all those experiences texturally. And I think it's just a marvelous experience. It's an experiential pie. That's what it is.
And is there an ideal size? And I'm thinking, is there a size that's too small?
Well, that's just it. It's called hand pie for a reason. So I think it depends upon the eater. And the mouth, the size of your mouth.
But
so
don't you
think?
I would
never say that a hand pie couldn't be so small. I mean, at some point, it becomes a Hoover Doover, an hors d'oeuvre, or like a little mini dessert or something like that. Or, you know, what's deceptive about them is that you might start with like a 6 by 6 inch piece of dough, and it looks like it's so big. But once you place the filling in, you fold it over, it becomes, you know, a little more than half the size. So often we make it where it might be 3 by 3, and then it turns into a 1.5 to 2 inch pie. It's small, little dainty guys. The most crucial part is to be able to have the proper ratio of filling to crust. So you're going to need a certain amount of that border to seal it in so it doesn't pop out and ooze everywhere. And then if it gets too big, then you have too much filling to crust ratio.
Okay, so I have questions. You have said fold it over. So are yours mostly like what we would think of as like a square turnover? Or do you ever just cut out all the pieces the same size and then put a piece on top of another of the piece that has the filling on it?
Okay, this is where you get my Brooklyn in me, because I grew up in Brooklyn. My grandmother, I loved everything in triangles. I like something with a point on it, because then you have all these different experiences that you go along with it. So now, that's not to say you can't do a rectangle. To me, then it turns more into, dare I say, a Pop-Tart. And if you do that often, once again, you've got a lot of dough around the outside. But, you know, if somebody's going to bake me something warm and fresh and hot and perfect, I'm not going to argue either way. I grew up on Hostess pies in my cafeteria in school, and those were those kind of oval shape on one side and the flat on the other. And I like those too. So I think it's your preference of what you like.
Okay, so let's talk about the filling for a minute. Ham pies take so much less time to cook that I imagine we're not doing what sometimes we do with a pie and just tossing our fruit with sugar and flour and sticking it in there.
Yeah, that won't work. Well, I guess it could with softer fruits, right? With a softer fruit and something that you might not want starch. And then, but then again, if the hand pie is going to be a little bit on the larger side, you're going to need something to bind it on the inside. I'm a pre-cooker. Anything that I could do in pieces and parcel out, the better. And I'll give you a little secret that I do. Height of the season, I take all my fruits, I bring them back, and I'll turn them into fillings right away. And then I take them and place plastic wrap on the inside, or we do seal pats. Professionally, we do seal pats. It's a plastic mat that goes into the sheet tray. And I pour the fillings out in there. And then what I do is I pop them all in the freezer. And then, depending upon the size of the hand pie I want to have, I cut out my rectangles, my squares, my triangles, and then pop it in the center. And then it, you know, defrosts as it's baking.
And so you're having to use...
mortified?
Not at all. No, you're so smart. I mean, you, for years, worked in a high-volume restaurant, so you had to do production baking. And I think a lot of home bakers can learn from that.
Yes, because when you have a filling that's so fresh, right? So let's say you pulled it off the, you know, you made a stovetop filling. You pull it off and you cool it, because you can't use, you know, hot filling on a cold, you know, on your cold dough. You got to cool it down anyway. And if you make it the day before, it'll gel or thicken a little bit in the fridge. If you were to go that route, you still have where you want it unctuous. And now you're going to try and take the dough and pull it over the top. And I'm sure everybody out there has felt this, where all of a sudden it starts oozing out the side. You're trying to seal it properly. Then you think, oh, no, I won't put as much filling in. And then you get frustrated, because then it's too much crust to filling. So that's my cheating way of doing it.
What kind of thickener are you using?
Depends upon the fruit. I'm a combination gal. Sometimes I'll do a combo of flour and cornstarch. Sometimes I'll just do butter, you know, mounting butter in at the end with apples. It really doesn't need to be thickened that much on a hand pie. It's different than the amount of internal area that you have on a big pie when you cut it, and it will start to ooze out. With a ham pie, especially if you use the technique that I do, the butter mounted in at the end will bind it as it freezes, and then by the time it cooks in the oven and sets back up again, it just makes it unctuous.
Do hand pies need to have little holes in them to let steam escape, like whole fruit pies do?
I do. I poke just, like, not a lot, just a whisper of a hole.
And does icing belong on a hand pie, in your opinion?
I'm gonna say it depends upon, once again, it depends upon the fruit. What did I just make? I made something with dates and oranges and filled it up. And nothing would be better than turbinado, just an egg wash and turbinado sugar, because then it balances out the apricot and orange and the date that's on the inside, right? And then maybe you're doing apricots on their own, and you've baked it, and you don't even egg wash it then if you're going to glaze the darn thing. I would put, if I wanted a confectioner's sugar glaze over the top of it instead, like that's my East Coast Hostess style, I would put ginger juice into the glaze, into the confectioner's sugar, because then it's going to bring this beautiful heat to it. So I guess it's ultimately what you want from how you're going to serve it or what the fruit is. I think that's the beauty of this pie competition, you know? The contest is so fabulous because it's almost like a Rubik's Cube of baking. You know, who picks what fruit? What do they want for the topping? There's so many different ways that you could do it. And it's up to your, you know, what your palate is and what your best judgment is. But for me, it has to do with the fruit that you're putting inside or the nut that you're putting inside.
Thank you so much, Sherry.
Oh my gosh. Are we going to stop talking? I can talk about pie for days.
That was Chef Sherry Yard. If you find yourself in Manhattan Beach, head over to 312 Rosecrans, and you might find Sherry in the kitchen on Saturdays and Sundays, except for Sunday, April 28th, when Sherry will join us on the demo stage and as a judge at KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest and contest at UCLA. Come as a baker or an eater. We'll have a demo stage, food vendors, a beer hall, music from KCRW DJs, and, well, plenty of pie. It really is our favorite day of the year here at Good Food. If you're a baker and haven't entered the contest yet, what are you waiting for? We have a bunch of fun new categories this year, including the hand pie category that we just talked about. After that conversation with Sherry, I have to say I wish I could enter. Go to kcrw.com/pie for details and to enter. We'll see you there. In a minute, the food of Bangladesh. Find out what makes it unique and how to cook it at home. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Identity is a multi-hued creation involving land, language, customs, and what we cover a lot on this show, food. So when Dina Begum's Made in Bangladesh came across our desk, we were thrilled to get a new look at an identity that is so colorful, complex, and delicious. Hi, Dina.
Hello. Hi, Evan.
Give us a geography and history lesson. Where is Bangladesh, and when did it become independent, and what are some of the historical influences related to the cuisine?
Right, so Bangladesh is a fairly new country. It gained independence in 1971, and it's at the Bay of Bengal, bordering India and Myanmar, Burma. Before that, it was a part of India, and then briefly, 47 to 1971, it was East Pakistan when India was divided, and then it became Bangladesh in 71. So it's a fairly new country, but it's always had a very distinct presence in terms of food and culture.
How linked is the food to Bengali cuisine, which is right next door?
Right. So there are plenty of overlap. So Bangladesh, when it was India and then a little bit after, it was Bengal, the whole region, which was West Bengal as it is now, part of India, as well as Bangladesh. So it's divided at the moment, but the language is the same and there are a lot of overlaps in terms of food. So in certain parts, especially along Dhaka, which is the capital of Bangladesh, there are more similarities, I'd say, with West Bengal. The Bengali food there. I specifically refer to it as Bangladeshi just to kind of make it distinct from Bengali food in general, although you can call it that too. Bangladesh is in terms of the country, the nation. And so the food, while we have a lot of similarities in terms of flavours and some of the dishes, it varies quite a lot because the further south you go down to Bangladesh, in especially different regions, each region has a very distinct food culture. For instance, I'm from the region of Sylhet, which is the northeast, and that's quite different. You've got kind of lots of fermented and dried fish, chilies, lots of kind of citrus fruits used in broths and stews. A lot of fish, obviously fish and rice are the main staples of the country. So while there are similarities, I'd say it's very distinct and quite unique to West Bengali food.
Tell us where you grew up in London and what helped form your Bangladeshi identity there.
So I've been in London since I was four, so pretty much all my life. And so I moved when I was very young. And we've always had a strong connection to Bangladesh, our Bangladesh heritage, food and culture in particular, due to my parents and extended family. And although I didn't visit Bangladesh much, I had that strong connection with relatives visiting us from Bangladesh, you know, having, you know, those 1990s phone calls, long-distance phone calls where everyone was shouting and it was very lively and people bringing gifts back from visits to Bangladesh. So there was always that strong cultural connection with our heritage and went to Bengali classes where we learned the language and poetry and literature. So I've always felt very much connected and I've learned to cook from my mother and grandmother. And then as I grew older, it was very important to me to kind of preserve and highlight those dishes, you know, not just to Bangladeshi people in the diaspora, but also to, you know, people interested in the cuisine and interested in Bangladesh as a whole.
You had two main trips to Bangladesh that you wrote about in the book. One was when you were a teen and one was later as an adult. Can you talk about what each of those trips sort of gave you and what different types of curiosity they sparked for you?
So when I was a teenager, I had my first trip back to Bangladesh, and that was mainly in our village in Sylhet. And I loved that purely for the food focus. You know, we were fed lots of delicious food by our extended family. And I saw, you know, the produce grown on our farm, you know, the cattle and the fish from the lakes. Everything was pretty much, you know, homegrown. So we had fresh, delicious dishes cooked every day over kind of wood fire stoves. So that piqued an interest in me. And I just realized the flavors are so much more different than the UK, even though we had traditional food, but there was lot more variety, and the traditional vegetables used and ingredients used made a huge difference. And then, you know, as we grew older, my dad had an allotment or a community garden when we moved to a house. So he started growing the produce that we saw in Bangladesh, the marrows, pumpkins, you know, leafy greens. So that really made me appreciate the importance of fresh produce in Bangladeshi cooking. So when I went back for my research trip for my book, I spent most of my time in Dhaka, the capital, and I hadn't spent much time there. So that was a kind of revelation, because as with any capital, people are bringing their regional food to the capital. And so that was really interesting in terms of eating and just kind of solidifying my ideas for the book as well.
If we already have an Indian pantry started, I mean, I actually have like two, you know, like plastic totes filled with Indian, with spices for making Indian food. What items should we add to it that are more specific, do you think, to the Bangladeshi kitchen?
So one thing which is also common in West Bengal, if you don't have already, you should definitely get Pach Puron, which is Bangladeshi or Bengali five spice. And it consists of nigella seeds, fennel, cumin, fenugreek, and mustard seeds. And that's a deliciously pungent, aromatic kind of spice blend used at the beginning of cooking in the hot oil. And that's used for mainly meat and vegetarian dishes. So you should definitely have that. Mustard seeds alone, either dark or light. Mustard oil, which is very important. There's, you know, contention going around mustard oil that it's not, you know, fit for consumption, but it's available. You probably see the bottles that says for external use only on mustard oil. But, you know, you can, you know, consume mustard oil and you can find them in Asian grocery stores, but obviously in moderation, you know. But mustard oil is a must, because in fish dishes in particular and in bortas, which are mashes of mainly vegetables or fish or meat sometimes. That's a staple in Bangladeshi cuisine, the bortas. So I would suggest definitely mustard oil, the Pach Puron, also nigella seeds separately as well. That's quite good in pastries as well as vegetarian dishes. And then I'd say if you can find a good date molasses from a Bangladeshi store, or sometimes Indian stores may have it, try and get that, as well as some, you know, dried fish. Fermented fish is hard to get sometimes unless you're in a very Bangladeshi neighborhood, but some dried fish, like you can even try dried anchovies, which are quite good for broths and things, and coconut. So they're not primarily spices, but I think those are the key ingredients in terms of a Bangladeshi pantry, as well as obviously rice. Definitely got lots of varieties of rice, sticky rice, regular basmati rice. And if you can get, a lot of my pastries use ground rice and rice flour. So those are two of the kind of pantry essentials, I'd say, in terms of flours.
So we're talking to you from Santa Monica. We're a citrus area on an ocean. here in California. So tell us more about the marriage of fish and citrus in the cuisine. And in particular, I'm looking at the recipe that is fish with clementine peel.
Mm-hmm. And you're lucky you're in Santa Monica with all the citrus, because if you can't get the traditional ones I referenced, definitely clementine you can find. But if you can't get the shatkora, which is specific to the Sylhet region, and it's a bittersweet citrus, and you just use the rind. So it's more of a cooking citrus, rather you wouldn't eat it on its own. So the flesh is kind of quite dry and not very juicy. So, you know, the peel is usually sliced off and used either dried and then rehydrated, or just used fresh if you have fresh available. So I think it's most popular in the Sylhet region, where I'm from, and other kind of coastal regions of Bangladesh, where there's, you know, an abundance of fruit and veg, and the citrus just adds a freshness to fish stews. I would say they're more broth-like, light stews, rather than a curry, which is more rich. So you wouldn't add much oil to those dishes. And it's definitely a summertime dish where the weather is milder. You have those dishes and it's really nice with kind of plain rice. It's just a perfect combination. And you've got the clementine peel, which is one of the classic one with the pabda. And then there's shatkora, which you can also use in fish, which is the bittersweet one I mentioned. And that's a stronger flavor, whereas the clementine peel adds a kind of a gentler aroma to the dish.
And if we can't find shatkora, can we substitute pomelo?
Pomelo is a good substitute, definitely. Or otherwise, I would say try and use grapefruit peel or like lime peel, like a mixture. Try and use a bitter kind of citrus with a sweet citrus to give that kind of bittersweet aroma of shatkora.
You have several menus that you've created that are at the front of the book, which I love. I always like to see examples of how to put dishes together. And one in particular just really leapt out at me, and that was the afternoon tea.
Uh-huh. I love afternoon tea.
Yeah. Can you talk about some of the dishes that you would serve at a Bangladeshi tea in the afternoon?
Mm-hmm. So tea is an institution in Bangladeshi culture. So you have tea any time of day. It could be morning tea, afternoon tea, or even evening tea. And they range from small kind of what you can have, a cup of tea or cha, as we call it, with a sweet or savory item or both. Or you can have a selection of dishes. So a common tea time or cha nasta snack would be shingara, which is like a samosa, pyramid-shaped, made with handmade pastry. And it's got a potato filling with the pachpuran, the spice blend that I talked about earlier. And that's a really aromatic, spicy kind of filling, potato filling. And obviously it's crispy and fried, and most people love crispy and fried food. So that's a great addition to kind of, you know, just livening up your afternoon. And also you might have nimki, which are fried pastry bites with nargila seeds. And that's a good one that's commonly eaten during cha nasta, as well as a halwa. I've got tushashini in there, which is a kind of flour halwa with spices and raisins. And that's quite nice to have for afternoon tea. Or you have various pitas, which are rice-based sweets or savouries. For instance, one of my favourites, the patishapta, which is a rice crepe filled with a rice cream with saffron and cardamom. So these are some of the kind of the classic afternoon tea dishes you'd have with your cha.
Also, the baked sweet yogurt. Mm-hmm. There's something about it. It looks so simple, but I can tell that it's something absolutely delicious.
You know, I would say that's one of my all-time favorites, and that's definitely a classic Bangladeshi or Bengali dish. And it's got a distinct burnt caramel flavor. It's basically milk cooked down with the addition of yogurt to kind of help it set. And it's got a caramelized sugar in there to give that kind of earthy, burnt taste to it. And it, when it's baked, it's almost kind of like a cheesecake texture or consistency. And it's light enough, but also quite rich. I'd say, what could I compare it to? Maybe a creme brulee. It's a classic in Bangladeshi meals, and that's eaten usually at the end of a meal, or you can also have that for afternoon tea as well. And that pairs quite well with the rosogulla, which are the round cheese dumplings soaked in syrup. So that's a good pairing if you have the mishti doi as well as the rosogulla, which I have a recipe for as well in the book. But yeah, it's such a simple dessert, but it has so much flavor.
The rosogulla are dangerously delicious.
Yes, absolutely. You need tons of them, especially when they're warm.
Tina, it's been so great talking to you. It's really a beautiful book.
Thank you, Evan.
So many engaging recipes. I can't wait to really dig in.
I'm so pleased.
That was Dina Begum talking about her new book, Made in Bangladesh. If you want to try making Dina's fish with clementine peel, we've got the recipe on our website. Just go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, dinner and a show. We go out for Peking duck in the San Gabriel Valley. Next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Are you hungry yet? Next up, we've got dinner and a show. Apparently, Bill Addison lives for the drama. This week, the Los Angeles Times restaurant critic takes us to a new spot in Temple City. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Evan.
Where are you taking us this week, and what is the specialty?
We are headed this week to Temple City in San Gabriel Valley to an upscale, high-design Chinese restaurant called Array 36. And the specialty is a variation on Peking duck or roast duck with a dramatic tableside presentation. I've heard the staff there refer to it as the fire show.
Okay, so describe the presentation. Describe how it is set aflame.
Yeah. So here's the scene. A chef will wheel a cart out from the kitchen, and there's a duck, a whole roasted lacquer duck, swinging from a hook that juts from the mouth of a swirling gold-plated dragon sculpture. The chef will pour over a variation of a Beijing-style spirit called baijiu, and then aims a butane torch gun, and whoosh, the already cooked duck goes up in flames for a theatrical few seconds, and it looks like the dragon is sort of grinning in the flames, you know, House of Dragons, Game of Thrones style. It's
amazing.
It's a lot of fun.
So once the flames die down, tell us about the different variations in which the duck is served.
Yeah, so the chef goes right to work. And first up would be a small plate of crisped skin cut into squares. And that's meant to be dipped into brown sugar that's in the center of a condiment tray. And then comes a pile of boneless slices of meat garnished with more skin. And another server will deliver the crepe thin pancakes that would be familiar to people who have ordered Peking duck in restaurants before. Those are for wrapping the duck with smears of hoisin and batons of scallion and cucumber. But then there is one last bit of theater where the chef carves some more meat onto an oval pedestal and covers it with a glass cloche outfitted for smoke infusions. And then there's a dramatic moment where it fills with smoke, and then a server rushes it to the table and lifts it off. And there's this campfire perfume that fills the air and clings to the duck. And honestly, the smoked duck is probably my favorite part of the presentation.
Yeah, I was going to say, so there's all this theatricality. Tell us about the deliciousness.
Yeah, it's actually, I mean, I do think that it's very good at the center of the drama, which is part of the reason that I was pulled to write about it, was that I think this is some of the best Peking-style duck, roast duck, happening in the San Gabriel Valley.
Do you have any, I imagine that the menu is more than just this particular presentation of duck. Do you have some suggestions for us on how we should focus on this menu?
Yeah, it's a little bit of an overwhelming menu, honestly. The chef, Shanghai native Tony Tao, offers a mix that includes Shanghainese and Cantonese and Sichuan and even some kind of modernist dimensions beyond all that. There's a dish of more Shanghainese origin. It's a variation on stir-fried river shrimp served with vinegar that I thought was very good. My favorite dish, arguably, was these wonderful earthy sweet snow pea leaves served in broth with a whole bunch of different ingredients, included roasted garlic cloves and chopped bits of Chinese-style ham and preserved egg and scallion. And the stock had a really lovely viscosity to it, like a suppleness that kind of married all the ingredients together. I think my overall advice for the restaurant is focus less on things like dumplings and bao there and more on braises and fresh seafood and seasonal greens.
And I have to ask, how many of these, the fire shows of the duck happen each night? I mean, do you have to reserve the duck in advance?
You do. It's pretty important. The restaurant takes reservations the old-fashioned way. You have to call. You cannot make reservations online. And there might be a little bit of a negotiation. The fire show happens about 20 times in an evening, which is really a lot when you think about it. And because it's so popular and word is out in the San Gabriel Valley community, there can sometimes be a negotiation. Like you call and say, I'd like a reservation for four, please. I want like the duck, the fire show. And they go, oh, okay, well, they're all kind of booked out that night. So you might need to be flexible about nights if you are dead set on wanting the duck. And I will say they serve roast duck whole or half straight from the kitchen without all the shenanigans as well. But the table side is what makes it fun and memorable.
Well, thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
That was LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison discussing Array 36 in Temple City. Want to read more about it? Visit our website for a link to Bill's review, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laryl Garcia, and Elena Shatkin, and to our engineers, Hope Brush and Sue Margulies. And a special thanks to Laura Kondarajan and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. If you're considering competing in this year's pie contest and haven't signed up yet, don't sleep on it. Go to kcrw.com/pie to sign up. I'll meet you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.